Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today, together with my co-host, Joy B.
Thank you for listening in. Today is mostly sunny with a small chance of showers earlier in the day. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a low around 39. This week, tomorrow through Sunday, should be sunny with temperatures in the low 60s. Nights will be getting down to the low 40s or high 30s. Alert, Saturday night is expected to dip down to the 30s. So that's a frost.
Thank you, Joy. Here's a summary of some stories of Iowa in the news from the Iowa Informer at iowainformer.com. The Board of Regents of Iowa State University and Search Committee will meet on Monday, that's today, to select Iowa State's next president. The president introduction will be live streamed following the announcement this evening. And for information, go to Iowa State University President Search. iastate.edu. On Tuesday, Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller joined with attorney generals in 17 other states to sue the Federal Department of Education and its secretary, Betsy DeVos, for failing to implement an Obama-era policy called the Gainful Employment Rule, meant to protect students from being defrauded from for-profit schools. DeVos previously justified delaying the rule by arguing that it would unfairly limit students' choices. When President Trump nominated DeVos to head the Education Department, she faced heavy scrutiny under her central role in establishing Michigan's poorly regulated charter school program. Last week, Fox News focused twice on political statements made by people in Ames after members of the Ames High School marching band walked off the field during a football game earlier this month in a show of support for NFL protests against racial discrimination. Columnist Todd Starnes wrote that the school, quote, has the unfortunate distinction of having one of the most un-American marching bands in the nation, unquote. It was absolutely disgraceful, he added, sickening. A few days later, Fox News drew attention to a recent tweet from an account apparently representing Iowa State University's Young Democratic Socialist Students Group that read, quote, the only dope worth shooting is in the Oval Office, unquote. Another tweet from the account approved of exterminating capitalists. The account has since been deleted. As the Iowa Informer first reported on Saturday, two lawsuits were filed hours apart earlier this month that both alleged ISU failed to adequately investigate students' reports of sexual assault on campus. The first lawsuit was filed against Robin Kelly, the university's former Title IX coordinator, by a former student who was allegedly assaulted in her dorm room in October 2013. Kelly herself filed the second suit against ISU, claiming that she faced retaliation and eventual termination after repeatedly raising concerns about compliance problems with Obama-era guidelines aimed to address campus sexual assaults. Her attorney said her case was an example of a systematic problem of sexual assault around the country and the constant battles that go on at universities that often fail to properly handle assault reports. And those are some headlines from Iowa in the News from the Iowa Informer. Thank you, Gavin. More stories can be found at iowainformer.com.
Sexual assault is so prominent in the news, from local stories at Iowa State to global stories, ranging from Hollywood to the federal government to the popular Me Too movement occurring internationally on social media. We spoke recently with Margot Foreman, the director of Iowa State University's Office of Equal Opportunity and coordinator of Title IX. We want to ask, what protections have there been in place historically at Iowa State University, and how ISU management views protections against sexual assault? Director Foreman was kind enough to come to KHOI and record this interview just a few days after Betsy DeVos, United States Secretary of Education, held a controversial press conference in early September. That signaled the federal government's continuing intentions to revoke Title IX guidelines that were put in place by the Obama administration. Title IX governs college campuses' policies on sexual assault. Ms. Freeman began the interview by explaining what exactly Title IX is.
Title IX is a federal law that was established in 1972 and is the prohibition from sex discrimination in education, period. Up until the revision to talk about sexual assault, Title IX really was associated with athletics. And the first impact on university campuses, in the 70s, when it was first introduced, the way that folks interpret it is just equalizing access to athletics. I think it was not established just because of athletics, but for quite a long time, that was how folks thought about Title IX. Until 2011, under the Obama administration, when the Dear Colleague letter came out, and that Dear Colleague letter from the Office of Civil Rights talked about sex discrimination.
Can you explain what a Dear Colleague letter is?
So Dear Colleague letter is the federal government's way of notifying guidelines to carry out compliance to these laws as they're written. So the first Dear Colleague letter under the Obama administration really had the heart of let's pump up our vigilance across our campuses to safeguard and be able to respond to sexual assault. That came from the Obama administration in 2011. All of this happened around the Sandusky issue at Penn State. If you can remember,
with child molesting.
Right. For 40 years, child molesting had been able to happen right under the noses of administrators and assistant coaches and parents on that campus. 40 years of abuse. So, of course, the federal response was hard on, we can't let this happen anymore. Right.
Yeah.
And that's where their focus stayed. It actually was a response that was necessary because we know one out of four women on college campuses say that they have experienced sexual harassment, discrimination, sexual assault, stalking, exploitation, fondling, those sorts of things.
Isn't it true that later on, the Obama administration also applied LGBTQ rights to Title IX?
Closer to the end of the administration in 2016, Vice President Joe Biden helped construct another Dear Colleague letter, which says to include LGBTQA communities. And so I think that Iowa State responded the way that most campuses responded across the country, to take a hard look at how they had resources and processes to address sexual harassment, discrimination, as well as sexual assault, and started to put together a program that followed the guidelines from the Dear Colleague letter to be able to give fair means to adjudicate cases, train faculty, staff, and students, help them understand the responsibilities to report, and have ways that we negotiated with our criminal processes in order to bear out the best outcome. And so what you saw was those coordinators became essential to how these programs were going to be carried out. We have almost 37,000 students, faculty, and staff who are all protected by the Title IX. We have some coordinators across campus that help do that in some essential places. Faculty staff who have been trained. We also tell them, what is your responsibility? Reporting crimes. We also have responsible employees. Anybody who has the ability to instruct, to guide curriculum, coaches, and then we have a couple confidential spaces. So our Sloss House for women, there is a confidential space, as well as our LGBTQA space for students.
You deal with Title IX complaints internally at Iowa State.
Yes. Sexual harassment, discrimination, Title IX, sexual assault, misconduct cases, and other civil rights cases for 40,000 plus people.
Are there a lot of complaints?
In a year, I think we looked at 163 what we call cases, 2016 and 2017.
And how much of those are sexual assault related?
I would say probably upward of about 70%.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's a significant number.
It is.
Is the process some sort of disciplinary process when there's a complaint?
It follows a substantiated complaint. There's a complaint can be brought by anybody, third party. It can be brought by someone who was,
like,
you know,
a roommate,
or it could be bought by the individual who's been impacted by the situation. Their witnesses and evidence, along with the witnesses and evidence that's provided by the accused, or the responder in this case, are all sought and followed through as much as we can. We look at the credibility of those individuals we've talked to or the evidence that we have. And we're using the preponderance of evidence standard that says pretty much, is this more likely to have happened than not to happen from what we've gathered?
So this issue of preponderance of evidence has become a critical issue for the current administration because Secretary DeVos has held a press conference stating a change in how Title IX will be interpreted by the current administration. We will get back to discussing this later.
As the Title IX coordinator for Iowa State, we keep our eyes and ears open. And so we've known for a while that there might have been some changes at the federal level around Title IX and how we're supposed to address it as a university, with Betsy DeVos now being the Secretary of State. We first saw this pullback of protections for LGBTQA individuals, which automatically make us think that any other work for Title IX may also be a pullback of regulations.
You're saying that you got a Dear Colleague letter that basically reversed protections for LGBTQ.
There was new language that came out from the Office of Civil Rights. That's a federal office. So Betsy DeVos would have authority. It wasn't a Dear Colleague letter, as I recall. It was actually new guidance that was just sent out across.
New guidelines.
Right. New guidelines that said that the Obama administration, Dear Colleague letter, overstretched Title IX by including this gender identity issue. That the Title IX provision didn't have a place for gender identity.
This was quite early on in the administration.
So maybe somewhere around 6 months ago.
And that was discrimination against
all individuals identifying specifically for LGBTQA folks. Okay. That gave more room on the state levels for challenges for protections for LGBTQA individuals. And we know that in North Carolina, there was a big case around protection about how K-12 students would have to identify to go to the bathroom of their choice. So we see that that is still rising across the nation.
So at Iowa State, if a transgender person goes into the bathroom of their choice, is there a problem with that?
There's not a problem with that.
Okay, so Iowa State would protect that still.
Right, from harassment and discrimination. Good. Individuals are able to self-identify for that.
Okay.
At Iowa State, we still adhere to doing what I say, we're going to do the right thing, protection from sex discrimination, and we're going to adhere to that in our policies.
In her first press conference about this, what did Secretary DeVos actually say?
She did a national press conference about what she discovered in her time in office around the issue of Title IX case handling. What we got from that conference was her trying to explain how she was making decisions and how the guidelines should be rewritten. There will be some announcement that says this is how we would look at the correct way to handle these issues, and then the public would be able to comment.
On a website, or how
it's usually done on a website. We anticipate we'll get a new Dear Colleague or some new announcement that says this is what we're looking at, and then it'll be open for public comment.
It would be posted.
Yes.
Online.
Yes.
And then open for comment.
Exactly.
Both from the university.
Everyone.
Would you comment within your role?
So we've talked about that just yesterday, that if the opportunity opens up, that we believe that we should respond. I would do that with a group of folks.
And what values will be you be coming from?
So the value statements, I think, would be that we would want to make sure that we're given due process.
You are listening to Local Talk. I am your host, Joy B, here with Ursula Rudenberg, and we are speaking with Margo Foreman, Director of Iowa State University, Office of Equal Opportunity, and Title IX Coordinator. We are discussing the announcements made by Secretary of Education DeVos regarding changes to Title IX regarding sexual misconduct. Can you explain why Secretary DeVos chose to speak about the rights of people accused of sexual assault?
University officials knew that there would be a propensity to rehash Title IX to include a more robust process for the accused. In the Dear Colleague letters that came from the Obama administration in 2011 weren't as specific around the rights of those who were accused. The focus was on those who were in crisis, those were folks who were potential victims. Those were the first individuals to talk about how they were being mishandled. The responders really weren't visible at the time because the reports weren't occurring. Cases weren't being handled across campus.
Rape cases weren't being handled?
Exactly.
There were no cases being tried.
Right. For a period before 2011, there wasn't any focus on mandating that universities across the country take accusations of sexual assault seriously and have a process in place to address them.
There was no real attention to the process for the accused because there were really no cases.
Absolutely. It's not because people weren't being impacted by sexual violence or
but
relationship
it wasn't
violence.
Being, but it wasn't being taken
it
to
wasn't,
trial?
It wasn't being addressed appropriately. And for many universities, that was something that was being shoved under the rug. The redress for those issues were very thin. If you don't educate students, faculty, and staff about what their rights are, if you don't give them a process, they can't bring cases forward because you haven't given them an avenue for it.
There was no real significant amount of cases regarding rape at college campuses. That's what you're saying?
That's right. So, of course, as you start to engage in processes which tries to bring individuals accountable for their actions, there is another side. We need to look at the reporter, and we need to look at the responder at the same level. Due process is something that everyone has a right to have, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is a time that we've come to now talk about, are we giving due process to those individuals who are responders to these cases?
What I'm hearing is that early on in the Trump administration, there was a very clear statement made about rolling back protections for LGBTQ community. Now you referred to a different message was also being conveyed about the seriousness of sexual assault. And are you concerned at all?
If I had any concern, it would be that I believe that it may provide a platform for individuals whose behavior is questionable to then throw out a blanket of freedom of speech rights and a blanket of academic freedoms so I can behave this way. And look, the federal government is saying it's okay when we talk about sex misconduct. So I believe that could happen. That means that we need to work with our faculty, provost office, our upper administration, and our students to say, freedom of speech is your right, but the consequences are real, impact people. And if they're directly targeting individuals and it is enough to be pervasive or is egregious enough to be a policy violation, we're going to hold you accountable to that.
What can you imagine the university might be forced to do?
The only change that I see would be the preponderance standard changing.
What does preponderance evidence of standard mean?
It would be the standard by which we say something did or did not occur, whether a policy has been violated. So if it moves to a more clear and convincing or a reasonable doubt standard, which is used on a criminal level.
You're worried that less people will actually report cases?
Absolutely. Because there's not enough evidence. A lot of cases aren't substantiated. So if you etch that standard up to clear and convincing or to beyond a reasonable doubt, it's going to be less and less cases that are substantiated, which leave victims to feel that you don't believe me. I haven't been heard, which is not the case. We may very well believe your story. There's not enough evidence. And the fact is that universities are not legal entities. Universities don't see their role as being criminal. And there's not a trial. There's a lot of language around kangaroo courts and criminalization in Mr. Voss's statement. That whole language sets in motion a vision that's not appropriate for university. We have processes, regardless if it's sexual assault and discrimination or if it's a drinking, underage drinking case. Her statement, I think, inflamed how university sees their role. The university's role is to have a process in place to investigate and to see if the policies of the university have been violated. If the policy of the university has been violated, then we are able to then hold them responsible.
There could be disciplinary action, but there's no criminal aspect to it.
There is
not
a criminal aspect. We work in tandem with ISU police, and we'll work it with Ames police or whomever. And a lot of times they're in front of the case. So those reports may have come from those entities. But the prosecution that causes folks to have a criminal record is not with the university. Mm-hmm. And it seems that that's how individuals are getting caught in the confusion. I hear words around trial and guilt, and that's, we talk about, are you responsible? We talk about, did you violate a policy?
Mm-hmm.
These are the processes. Is it a code of conduct violation?
So I'm trying to understand. Tell me if this makes sense. What Betsy DeVos is saying does not affect the criminal justice system. She's not talking about the process of prosecution of a sexual assault. What's the difference? I mean, in the end, what DeVos is saying isn't necessarily enabling sexual assault. Either it happens or it doesn't.
If those individuals who are prospective perpetrators believe they have now been given an extra protection that they won't be held accountable or do sexual misconduct. What I do believe is they won't think as hard about what are the consequences if they should behave that way. So they may not be motivated by it, but they surely not necessarily going to be dissuaded by it either. I think we'll have more victims on campus who don't get redress. It's not going to help universities address sexual assault. An individual who engages in sexual misconduct of any kind are, for the most part, acting on their individual decision-making processes. It's a choice. And I don't think that Betsy's decisions will impact whether or not they use individual power. So if or don't respect other individuals, they'll behave that way because that's innately a part of who they are. What we would hope is that the processes will be such that they understand if I go with my intent, I know there's a possibility that I'm definitely going to be held accountable. That's where I think.
So there's just a little bit less of a
fear factor.
Fear factor.
About consequences.
So you're saying it's not initiating it because that comes from the individual, but there's less things in place to maybe stop it.
Right, to deter that.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Rape culture is a big issue, and that's where I would hope that she would spend a lot of her time to talk about the rape culture on campuses, that interpersonal violence that's happened is real. For instance, what does it mean to have the right to be educated without sexual assault? And there's not anything coming from the federal government, from the new administration, regarding what does culture look like and how do we change it to make it less likely that students will be impacted by sexual misconduct. That's where our energy should be spent.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts today, here together with Joy B. If you just joined us, we were speaking with Margo Foreman, director of Iowa State University's Office of Equal Opportunity and the coordinator for Title IX at Iowa State. She was describing the history of Title IX and how ISU has viewed protections against sexual assault and how the federal government is revoking guidelines for protections that have been put in place by the Obama administration and changing the definition of Title IX.
It's somewhat strenuous to understand how government filters down locally, but it is also important to hear what people like Director Freeman can offer in terms of understanding about how federal administration's outlooks can affect us through changing local bureaucracies. Since this interview, DeVos made an announcement on Friday, September 22nd, that the Education Department are free to abandon the previous standard of proof, ponderance of evidence on sexual assault and raise it to a higher standard known as clear and convincing evidence. The move has been long sought by advocates for accused students, most of whom are men, who had complained that campus judicial processes had become heavily biased in favor of female accusers. Fatima Goss Graves, president of National Women's Law Center, an advocacy group for women's rights, said DeVos' announcement would have a devastating impact on students and schools. She said in a statement, "It will discourage students from reporting assaults, create uncertainty for schools on how to follow the law, and make campuses less safe."
The Department of Education said that it plans to finalize and craft a new and permanent Title IX regulation. Joy, recently you yourself found yourself involved with a nationally recognized art exhibit speaking out about sexual assault.
Yes. Taylor Yoakum started a photography exhibit project about sexual assault in 2014 after a rash of sexual assaults in Iowa City, where she was living and attending school at the University of Iowa, where she received her Bachelor of Arts degree. She and some of her classmates had a conversation about how to protect themselves. This conversation was the inspiration for Guarded, a photo exhibit at the end of the school semester whose images went viral when it was picked up by a celebrity blog. Taylor spoke with us on the phone from St. Louis, Missouri, where she is working towards her Master's of Fine Arts at Washington University.
Tell us what is in the exhibit. What makes this so unusual?
I took portraits of college women and female-identified people holding what they use to protect themselves from sexual assault. I saw the body of work Guarded as a way to shed light on rape culture and how pervasive it is. I recognize that sexual assault is much bigger than the idea of the stranger jumping off the bushes, but it's that too. So by showing keychains or things that are on you all the time, having this double life as a weapon in case of an attack, it just shows how on guard we have to be. Because if you think about your keys that you use to get into your house, but also use between your fingers and walks home at night, it really speaks to the gravity of the situation.
And why did you name the project Guarded?
On my keychain, I had my pepper spray, and also I had a bike key that always said on guard. So I think I kind of conflated those two together, and I wanted to think of Guarded as this idea of how you always have to be aware of this as an issue, and just kind of by extension of how women are always on guard.
Describe what exactly are in the photographs.
The photographs are portraits, are black and white, of these women just holding up what they use. So there's anything from things that are actually marketed as sexual assault prevention or weapons such as pepper spray, to more mundane objects such as flashlights and keys, or even things that aren't even meant to be used for those purposes, such as cell phones or water bottles.
How did you go about getting these portraits? Did you go to people and say, what do you use to protect yourself? What do you carry at night?
Yeah, I did that sort of open call. This was originally started as a school project when I was a junior. And so for that, I set up a studio over on campus. I let my friends know and really tried to encourage strangers to be a part of the project.
How did a normal process with somebody go? You would sit them down and say, tell me what you use to protect yourself?
Yeah, it was pretty simple. I mean, these are all things that my peers and I were pretty used to, so it was pretty casual. Usually nothing more than taking out your keys or showing your rape whistle, and then I take a portrait of them.
And how close or far away were you from the person, and were they looking at the camera or at something else?
They were looking directly in the camera. That eye contact and neutral expression was really important for me. And they were set up probably about 5 feet away.
So they had made eye contact with the camera, and you asked them to keep a neutral expression on their face.
Yeah.
Why was that important for you, for them to look neutral?
I didn't want someone having a cheesy smile, but also I thought too emotional of an expression would make the work look different than how I intended, so I thought a neutral expression and a powerful gaze into the camera is really important, both to subvert the male gaze that's so prominent in art history, but also to have a really powerful and unified stance.
Were you also trying to make the instrument that they were holding itself more of a subject?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see how the object relates to the person, because it can be seen as something entirely separate, or it can be seen as something as an extension of the person.
It's interesting. It's almost like it's a portrait and a still life in one photograph.
Oh, I've never heard that. That's really interesting.
You mentioned that some of the things, like let's say a spray or a whistle,
are marketed to women. And I find that interesting. Like, I one time bought a whistle just because it was cute. It had flowers on it, and I thought, oh, I like that. Sometimes they would market some of the mace with pink with a Hawkeye emblem on it. Do you have any thoughts on that, how some of these...
The commodification of fear?
Yeah.
No, it definitely is a commodification. You can't see in the portraits since they're all black and white, which I kind of like how that plays out, but there's lots of hot pink or baby blue or, like, almost feminizing these objects.
Yeah, and you chose black and white. Do you know why you chose to have them in black and white?
Back when I was really adamant about having it black and white and making it look unified and thinking that having it black and white would give it this kind of a stoic or monumental look.
When you took these portraits, did people tell you their story?
Yeah, if we were in an intimate studio space, so sometimes it did evolve into that. But if you're taking portraits of people, it's important to have a sense of community and have those discussions rather than just going in, taking a picture of someone and leaving.
And did this, were most of the stories about actual times when they had to defend themselves or about worries about defending themselves or actual assaults?
Yes. Allowing them the agency to portray themselves in that way hopefully did create a really positive experience.
Joy B was one of the people who's portrayed in the photographs, and so you went through the experience.
Right. I went through the experience, and for myself, it was a way for me to have a voice through a picture. That was, for some reason, healing and empowering at the same time, and a little fearful, too. The reaction to it was really surprising that it went viral. You know, I was actually later excited that, okay, our voice is being heard in a silent way through a picture. And but it's very powerful that you're not speaking, but they're just seeing, and it ignited a worldwide conversation.
What did you feel you were able to say with your portrait?
Just, you know, how vulnerable we are. I felt a lot of people in the conversation that went viral saw that, geez, this is what my sister, my daughter, my female friends have to do every day to possibly prevent an assault that they have no way oftentimes of knowing when it's going to happen or if it's going to happen to them.
We're speaking with Taylor Yoakum, who was a student at Iowa City at the University of Iowa, and she did a photography exhibit, portraits of women who were displaying the objects they carried around to defend themselves against sexual assault. Joy B was one of the people that was photographed. Taylor, you put this exhibit together as part of your schoolwork at the University of Iowa. As you were putting the exhibit together, what did you find was important to you about making this project?
I was a young artist at the time. I found my artistic voice and talk about something that mattered to me.
And then what happened next?
It was May 2015. I wanted the project to get attention, so I submitted it to a few blogs. Giggles, the blog, had a call out looking for artists to feature, so I sent my work there.
And tell us what Hello Giggles is.
It is a blog for women, arts and culture and media and lifestyle blog. Within a few days, I had a reply saying they loved it and they wanted to do an interview. I did an interview and some of the work was featured on their website. And then I woke up the next morning and I had a few emails from Huffington Post and BuzzFeed. And then from there, it just all snowballed and I had so much media attention.
And so what went through your mind when you found out that your project had basically gone viral?
It was really exhilarating. It was also at a really spectacular time because it coincided with graduating from college. It affirmed my commitment to being an artist. And from there, I was able to use that clout or that exposure to continue the project and go to other campuses, take photos, and build on the work. I also, going viral, I really had the confidence to think about going into grad school. So I applied to Washington University in St. Louis for their Olin Fellowship for Women Pursuing Graduate Study. And that's a full ride. So I ended up getting a fellowship for grad school.
And have you continued to photograph women with their guard objects?
Yes, I was able to go to a lot of colleges in the past year. Most recently, I took some portraits at the University of Cincinnati.
So in the big picture, what do you think your exhibit has contributed to the conversation about sexual assault and vulnerability of women?
I hope that it brought more attention to the issue. I think portraits do have that power to increase empathy, so I think it did call attention to the issue in that way.
So you're saying that you feel that the power of it is that when people can actually put a real person's face to that fear, in a way the object is a symbol of the fear, and then there's a person's face connected to that, that makes it possible for people to really comprehend that fear? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I really don't think it should be that way, because I think with an issue like this, there should be empathy for it, regardless of it having a face attached to the issue. But I think having these portraits and showing these women and their agency and all having a very powerful and determined expression on their face, I hope that create an emotional response to mm-hmm. the issue.
Do you have a count or an idea of how many people viewed your guarded projects?
I know the BuzzFeed post got over 1 million views.
Wow. Have you gotten feedback from people that they were surprised that women were afraid?
Yes, I did get some people saying that they had no idea this happened.
And are most of those people men, or did you get that from women too?
Typically all men, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was the strangest object that you encountered in these photographs that a woman produced?
I think probably the strangest thing for me was seeing these objects that are every day being used as another purpose, such as water bottles.
Seen as a weapon instead of as what they're supposed to be used for?
Yes.
I wouldn't think of a water bottle.
But it's kind of a metaphor for how this is part of daily life, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Taylor, what are you doing now?
I'm working on the gender performativity of female niceness. So I'm doing mixed media installations, looking at things such as mansplaining.
Mansplaining?
Mansplaining.
Could you break that down a little bit for our audience?
Yeah, I'm looking at the gender performativity, which is how gender is performed through actions, coupled with female niceness, where women are expected to always be nice. And then I'm making mixed media and video installations out of that.
The connection between female identity and the behavior of being nice?
Yes.
Taylor, your exhibit, Guarded, can be seen online. Could you give the website where a listener could go to the web and see the work?
Yes, you can see my work at taylorjoe.com.
Repeat that again slowly.
You can see my work at www.taylorjoe.com. The Guarded series, as well as links to press interviews and also statements, are up there, as well as my recent video and installation work.
Okay. Thank you. So you're kind of right at the beginning of a pretty impressive career. What do you feel as an artist is really inspiring you the most as you develop your voice as an artist?
I think the thing that inspires me the most is seeing people have conversations about these issues, and that makes me want to create something in response to it.
Do you feel there's a need to talk about it more?
I do, yeah, especially in the wake of everything that's going on.
Yeah, like, yes,
everything
for sure.
That's going on. Everything that's always going on.
Sexual assault.
I think the most important takeaway I want people to get from this project is that it's a metaphor for how pervasive sexual assault actually is.
And Taylor, are you in one of the photographs?
Yes, I am in there.
And what are you holding?
I am holding a can of pepper spray.
Put on your face, know your place. Shut up and smile, don't spread your legs. I could do that, but no one knows me, no one ever will. If I don't say something, if I just lie still, would I be that monster, scare them all away? If I let them hear all I have to say, I can't keep quiet. No, I can't keep quiet, no. A one-woman riot.
An interview with Taylor Yoakum, photographer, mixed media artist, printmaker, and creator of the acclaimed photography exhibit Guarded.
And Allison Walter from the Ames Convention and Visitor Bureau has joined us. Welcome, Allison.
Good morning.
It's nice to have you back.
Thank you.
Okay, so talk to us about the month of November. And the end of October, too?
A little bit on the end of October.
Okay, let's
there
do
is
it.
A lot going on. Of course, this week is homecoming week for Iowa State University. They kicked off yesterday with the parade. And
downtown.
Lots going on throughout the community on campus as well as throughout the community. And they'll have a pep rally on Friday night and, of course, the football game on Saturday. You can check out the Iowa State Alumni Association's website for all the details. We've got some fun floral classes. Coase Floral up in Somerset does Tuesday night design classes every month. And this week is the October workshop. It's on trend for 2017, so you'll learn about what all the designers are doing in Christmas decorating for this year. And then also on November 21st is Harvest Bounty. It says, why should the turkey get all the attention? I like that. A fun make and take class on Thanksgiving centerpieces. So you can find out more about that at Coase.
That sounds nice.
Yeah. There is an exhibit at the Morrill Hall Textiles Museum, and it is all about textiles communicating through cloth, and it is open through November 10th.
And that's open now?
Yes, uh-huh. It's on exhibit now. And then also on exhibit now at the Design on Main Gallery, works of three Iowa State University faculty from different art and design disciplines are highlighted now through November 4th. And it features complementary works by a professor in architecture, one in graphic design, and an assistant professor of art and visual culture. So that should be interesting. They're open from 11 to 3 throughout the week. Iowa State Center has a ton of shows this month. They kick off this week with Bob Dylan and his band on the 24th. They have One Night in Memphis on the 26th, Bumper Jackson's on the 27th, the Black Jacket Symphony, Purple Rain, is on the 31st, Rebirth Brass Band on November 2nd, and Love on the Floor on November 3rd. They're doing Cat in the Hat from Dr. Seuss on November 8th during the day at 10 and 12:30, and that's part of their school series. And also on this month, November 3rd, the weekends of November 3rd and 4th and 10th and 11th, ISU Theater is doing the Children's Hour.
Lots of entertainment.
Yes. Yeah. And then also on November 14th at Stevens is the Vienna Boys Choir. So lots and lots going on there at Iowa State Center. We also have Story Theater Company with their production of The Spell of Sleeping Beauty. And that is November 3rd, which is the Friday night, 3rd and 10th at 7 o'clock. And then on Saturday and Sunday, they do 2 o'clock matinees both weekends. And it is at Ames City Auditorium. And then we've got some other fun things. The Workspace does their paint your own pottery nights.
And that's in the Union, right?
Right, in the Workspace at the Union. Every Friday from 4 to 8, and you can go in. There's a small fee, and then you also pay for the bisque that you choose depending on the theme of the night. Mm-hmm. So this Friday, of course, they'll do a Halloween theme, Halloween date night. November 3rd is Giving Plates, and November 10th is Let It Snow. So on the Fridays that classes are in session, they will do the Paint Your Own Pottery Nights. Kind of fun. Cyclone Cinema, you can see free movies on campus Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. They show wonderful current films at 101 Carver on campus. Shows at 7 and 10 all four nights.
And that's for everybody in the community,
yes,
right?
Yes, everyone's mm-hmm. welcome.
You don't have to be a student.
No, you do not have to be a student. And they sort of mix it up. They'll do a family-friendly show one week, and then the next might be not so family-friendly. Mm-hmm. And so there are some great family movies that you can go to. Alluvial Brewing Company is started a barbecue and beer event on Friday nights, and they have partnered with Cornbread Barbecue, and so you get barbecue from the food truck and craft beer from Alluvial, and then they always have live music. And so you can check out their Facebook page or our website to find out who the music is from. But great barbecue and some great craft beer here locally. Bergie's is doing an open mic night, and that's the last Friday of every month. And that's the Bergie's on Airport Road there by Lowe's. And so enjoy some live music. They actually are looking for people to come in and perform. And so priority goes to performers who are new, their first time. And then they also have some regulars that like to come in and perform every week. And there's serving coffee drinks and teas and some craft beers. And it is a very family-friendly environment. So everyone can enjoy their open mic night on the last Friday of every month. And then, of course, it's time to start thinking about the holidays. And Main Street Cultural District will be doing their Snow Magic kickoff on November 10th. And that'll be from 5 to 8 in the evening. And they'll do free carriage rides that take you through the downtown mm-hmm. cultural district area. At 6 o'clock, Mayor Campbell will light the official Snow Magic tree in Tom Evans Park. And there'll be, of course, the official lighting of all of the lights atop the Main Street buildings for the season.
It's going to be one of her last official duties,
isn't
it?
Yes.
Yeah, for the mayor.
Yes.
She's retiring in January, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. She'll be not running for re-election. So. And then also the Octagon Center for the Arts will host Santa that night, and they'll be kicking off their annual Festival of Trees. And that will go for about 2 weeks there at the Octagon. Mm-hmm. And, of course, also that weekend of Thanksgiving is Small Business Saturday. And this has been a great promotion for the downtown area. you know, promoting that people shop small on the Saturday after Thanksgiving. So come down to Main Street. Many businesses will be opening early around 9 o'clock. They have some great bags for the first 200 shoppers. You can pick up your swag bag. And also they will be doing cookies and milk with Santa down at the Depot Deli from 10 till noon. So it's all part of the Snow Magic events that go on starting November 10th through the rest of the holiday season. And you can find out more about those on their website. Or you can find out details on all of these things, and there are a lot more that I didn't include.
Wow.
And our website, Sites of Ames, is a great place to go for information and things to do, places to shop, places to stay.
And that's a C-Y-T-E-S
of Ames.com.
C-Y-T-E-S
yep.
of Ames.com.
Right. Named
mm-hmm.
after our favorite mascot, Cy. So, or you can also do thinkames.com, and that'll take you to our website as well.
Thinkames.com.
Yep.
Thank you, Allison Walter. Any last words from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau?
Well, you know, last month we talked about the Ames Community Grant Program.
Mm-hmm.
We have not announced the winners, but the committee is meeting and reviewing. We received 49 applications for
wow.
grants this
That's
year,
great.
Which is
wow.
amazing. So
lots of
some
stuff
great
going
things
on.
That mm-hmm. happen in our community, and we're really excited to be able to support those. So
okay.
we'll keep you posted.
Okay. Thank you, mm-hmm. Allison Walter from the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, and we'll see you next month
for yes.
the update on what's happening around our community. And thank you. And we've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI. Earlier in the show, we heard from
Margot Foreman,
director of Iowa State University's Office of Equal Opportunity and coordinator of Title IX, and Taylor Yoakum, photographer, mixed media artist, printmaker, and creator of the acclaimed photography exhibit, Guard It. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from the CD, The Ballad of Kay Shelley. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also remember that you can hear it live at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard about during the program today. KHOI streaming live online at khoifm.org. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we will train you. Come and join the Local Talk team.
Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting One Night in Memphis, a night of rockabilly, country, gospel, and 1950s rock and roll, on Thursday, October 26th at 7:30 p.m. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.